Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our fourth installment in Megillat Rut, in the magical book of Ruth. And I want to dedicate this chus. The merit of our learning tonight should be an aliyah, an elevation for the neshama of Lila Meir, of Leah, Bas Reb Shmuel, the Pesel. Should be an aliyah, an elevation. He has a chorvaruch, her memory shall always be for a blessing. So last week, we spoke about the mutuality of the relationship between Ruth and Boaz, and the reluctance on behalf of the Moabites, the Moaviyah, Ruth, to accept this generous offer of support from Boaz, because she felt, as her great-grandfather Lot felt when he was the recipient of Abraham's kindness, that perhaps there were strings attached. And she asked in verse number Yud, which is Perek Bet, the second chapter, verse 10, it says, Vatipol al panaha, that Ruth fell upon her face, Vatishtachu arza, she bowed down to the ground, to the earth. Vatamar elav, and she says to Boaz after his offer, she's not saying yes, she says, Madua matzati chen beinecha lahakireni, what's going on? What have I done to find favor in your eyes that you should recognize me? Va'anachi nochriya, I'm a nochriya, I'm a stranger. I'm not even a member of the nation, ostensibly. So why are you giving me this? I appreciate it, but if it comes with strings, remember, I'm a Moabitess. Sorry, I'm not going to accept. So then Boaz responds with the following. Vayam Boaz vayomer lo. And Boaz answered, and he said to her, Hugadli. No. Rest assured. I have been fully informed. Now, Hugad, Hugad is what they call Lashon Kaful. It is a double language. Whenever the Torah doubles up on a verb, it's to accentuate something fully. So, for example, most famously in the Shema, right? Vahaya im Shamoa Tishme'u. If you will surely listen to my commandments. So it's to accentuate the power of it. So here he's saying, no. Look, I've already been completely brought up to date. I've heard nothing about these magical stories going around Bethlehem about how you have accompanied Naomi as a member of my family back and all the wonderful things that you have done. Now, this is the proof, we alluded to this last week, that when Boaz asked his foreman, who's the young lady? Well, here he says, but I've already been fully informed. So at what point? Clearly then, that was a rhetorical question. It wasn't meant, I don't know who she is, please tell me. He already knew everything about Ruth. So this is the proof then, do you hear this? That this is the raya, this is the proof that when he asked earlier to his foreman, a few verses earlier, who is the young lady in the field, he already knew who she was. He wanted to hear his assessment. He wanted to hear his take on Ruth. And when he disparaged her in front of him, big mistake, he blew him up, essentially. He embarrassed him because he's, you know, as the man is speaking, he's looking and he's getting the Darth Vader stare as he's stumbling and bumbling through his words about how she's not worthy of you, you know, that she's not really a sincere convert. And as he's talking, he starts to lose his train of thought because he realizes, oh my gosh, he really wasn't asking me for details. He already knows. He just wanted me to say something nice about Ruth. Now, we never said, what was it? What was it about Ruth that attracted the eye of Boaz? We know that he knew all about her, yes. But what caught his eye? And in other words, for him to come the day of his getting up from Shiva, to come to his own field, wonderful. But that he recognized her instantly, this is someone different. What was it? That we didn't say. Remember? And the rabbis in the Gemara say what? The chief rabbi comes to a town, he starts recognizing beautiful girls? Like what? So the rabbis have a lot to say about this. Some say it was his sense of her modesty in contrast to the rest of the people. When she would glean, pick up the leftovers, the gleanings of the barley harvest, unlike the other women who kind of just hitched up their skirts and, you know, knelt down in an immodest way, she would either sit down or stand in a very modest way not to expose her body to anyone. She also was very careful to only glean two but not three or more, because by Torah law, the poor person has a limit to how much they're allowed to pick up for themselves. And she was very careful. So he noticed, oh my gosh, this young lady's watching her, and he thinks she went to yeshiva or something. She knows the laws, the halachas. And he was impressed. How could this stranger know? And then it starts to, the full impact of who she must be dawns on him. I mean, it's clear that she wasn't wearing a name tag. I am Ruth. Now, it could be that you may argue her levush, her dress was different. Okay, it could be, but she didn't exactly have great fancy schmancy, you know, Moabite design, Givenchy outfits, right? So it was more her behavior, her hanhaga, and her meticulous care to the letter of the law, not to take which was not hers. That attracted the eye of Boaz. Okay? So Boaz responds and says, look, this is verse Yud Aleph again, 11. He says, I have been fully informed. Kol asher asis es chamoseh. Everything that you did for your mother-in-law, Naomi, acherei mos isheich, after the death of your husband, Machlon. I know all about it. But tazvi avich ve'imeich, how? You left behind your father and your mother, the eretz moladet teich, and the place of your birth, the land of your birth, v'telchi el am, and you went to a people, to a nation, asher lo yadat, that you did not know. You weren't familiar with the Jewish people. Tamol, from etmol, from yesterday. And shilshom, the day before yesterday. Shilshom is almost a contraction of shalosh yom, like the day before the day of before yesterday. Tamol shilshom is always used as a description of the past. So we say etmol shilshom, from yesterday, the day before yesterday, going back. Okay, let's stop for a second. Did you notice a similarity, perhaps, in Boaz's words here, in compared to the first words of the famous parsha Lech Lecha? Remember, let's start with Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetecha el beit avicha. Get out, God says to Abraham, get out from this land, from the place of your birth, the place of your father, el ha'aretz asher areka, to the land that I'm going to take you to, that I'm going to show you. So, many of those words, the father, the mother, the place of your birth, avicha, they're all there. So clearly, again, Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel, is echoing, in the words of Boaz, the actual words of God to Abraham to leave behind and go to Israel. She's left behind her family, forsaken her culture, the Moabite culture, to come to the promised land of Israel. So what is Boaz doing? He's equating Ruth with Abraham. Except Ruth one-ups Abraham. God didn't tell her to go. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of impressive when God himself comes to you and says, you know, get up and go. You say, yes, sir. But when it's your own neshama, your own soul, your own spiritual essence telling you, and there's no one ordering you, that's even beyond. So he's actually praising her beyond Abraham. He's saying, no one told you to go. You did it out of a love of fidelity, first and foremost, to your mother-in-law, Naomi, and secondly, to what you believe to be the chosen people. You want to be part of it. So you have forsaken everything. You are a princess in your home. I mean, think about this. Her ancestor was that big, fat King Eglon, who was the king. So when we speak about a princess, we're not talking, you know, like in the disparagement, you know, someone's a princess and they're, you know, like they think they're hot stuff. She really was hot stuff. She came from tremendous Moabite genealogy. So to forsake the palace and all the accoutrements that would come with that, to go barefoot back to a strange land, and she knew, coming to Israel, she knew she would be marginalized. Because, I want to emphasize this, the fact that she could legitimately marry into the Jewish people, a Jewish man, was only rediscovered and reintroduced in the court by Boaz a couple of days earlier. So, in the fields of Moab, when she is making the decision, the monumental life choice to accompany mom, Naomi, her mother-in-law, all the way back, she could not have known what the law was. To her, the biblical dictate was, no man or woman from Moab can ever marry. That means they can convert, yes. But even 10 generations from their conversion, they can only marry another fellow convert. They cannot marry a Jewish man. So that's what Naomi was saying to them, if you recall, on the road back home. She was even using this as a weapon to dissuade her, if you recall. She says, look, I don't have any children to offer you. You can't marry a normal Jewish person. You could marry maybe someone in my family because we already have this relationship, but there's no one else. So for her, with no prospects of remarriage, with no money, leaving her Cayman Islands account and the access code behind in Moab, everything was left behind. She had nothing. And to do it without even a calling from God, Boaz says, whatever you think I'm giving you with barley, you're like Abraham. Oh my gosh. You're Abraham and Sarah combined. That's how wonderful you are. So I know all about what you've done. And then he carries on. Yud Beis, number 12. Yishalem Hashem pa'alech. God should pay you back. He's blessing her. May God reward your work, your actions. Usehi maskortech, and may your sachar, your reward, be shleima. May it be shalem, complete. Me'im Hashem Elokei Yisrael, from God, Hashem, the God of Israel, asher bas, that you came, lachasos tachas kenafav, to seek shelter under the protective wings of God. I mean, beautiful words, right? They're like poetic, because we even say to somebody when they die, you know, that you should be protected under the kanfei hashchina, under the protective wings of the mother. And you know where that expression comes from, by the way? When birds mate, they do it with sneas, with modesty. They cover each other, apparently, with the, I've never seen this, but I'm just, I assume this is true. They actually will protect each other, sort of, like, you've seen this? They actually shelter each other. Have you heard of this? Yeah. They will actually use their wings to protect people so they can't see them mating. So it's a form of sneut. It's a form of modesty that birds have. So we talk. I'm sorry?
A chuppah as well?
You mean there's a metaphor there? Yeah, I guess there is. But this is essentially, you know, closing the blinds down, right? Most animals don't have that instinct. Birds apparently do. Dogs and cats and others don't have that type of modesty. Although cats are considered a very modest creature. Doctor?
What gives Boaz the ability or the comfort zone to make the blessing, may Hashem reward your actions? That's a rabbinic type.
He is the head chief rabbi of all the world. He is the number one guy. We began, do you remember Shifot HaShoftim, that the judges were in charge?
Yes.
He was, Ivtsa, he's Boaz, he was the head rabbi of the highest court in the world. So the Sanhedrin used to meet, it was the high court of the 71 rabbis, he was the Moses of that court. So therefore, it would be like getting a blessing from, you know, Moses.
Right.
No different.
Why didn't they mention that anywhere in the story?
Like, that who Boaz really was?
Boaz,
yeah.
You know, Rabbi of, or, you know, quite often somebody's...
Why did they call him Rabbi though? Rabbi.
Right, absolutely. Okay, so there's two separate questions. Why is his name not, like later on in the Talmud, we meet the stages, they're always Rabbi Akiva. If it's the head of the Sanhedrin, they actually have a special title, Rabban, Rabban Gamliel. Well, Rabban is, with the extra nun, means you're the rabbi for everyone, correct? So let's answer the first question first. Why not a title? Why isn't he Rabbi Boaz? Or why not, right? So the greatest honor bestowed upon any individual is to be the first person with that name in the Torah. In other words, we never refer to Yahushua ben Nun as Rabbi Yahushua. Now, clearly, if we had lived in the time of Yahushua ben Nun, you would never have addressed him as Yahushua. You would never say, hey, you know, Joshua, can we... You would say, Rebbe, King, whatever. I'm sure they had a way of addressing him. You would never have spoken to Moshe Rabbeinu as with his first name. It's disrespectful. We refer to him as Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, because it's his Torah. But the greatest honor, the reason we don't call Avraham Avinu like Rabbi, even though he was clearly a rabbi, the first, is because it's even a greater honor to be Stam, just to be unaccredited, which is the reason Hillel and Shammai are never referred to as rabbis. They were the first to ever own that title. So anyone subsequent who lived after them, who was given that title, was always a rabbi. So it was like Rebbe Hillel so-and-so, but they're named after the original model. So to be the original model is in itself the greatest honor, to be the first person, because why should that be then? I have an answer for you. Because the name defines the character. In the same way, when we choose a name for our son or daughter, we name them after someone in our family that we wish this person to emulate their actions and their attributes, their midot. Well, think about it. If the person is named Boaz, Bo in him is azut, power, strength. So that means it defines the name after his personality. right? Moshe, the one who will draw forth the Jewish people from slavery. So in other words, the original name defines the essence, the defining characteristic of that person. So therefore, it's owned by them. So therefore, the Torah just chooses not to call a person by their working title. But clearly, in the time of Boaz, when he sat down in the Sanhedrin, as we'll see later in chapter 4, he didn't play games. I mean, you'll see in chapter 4, he's sitting there. He basically sits down and says, come here, pal, we're assembling a court. He just snapped his fingers, and they just come, because he's Boaz, he's Ifsan.
You know, if he had all the responsibility of being the head rabbi of Sanhedrin, why would he be out in the fields? Why would he,
Excellent question. So, exactly. So he did both. He was a landowner. He was a landowner also, and they had just now recovered from a horrific famine. Do you remember the famine began the text? They had a horrific famine that sort of pushed Elimelech over the edge when he ran away and deserted the promised land. So Boaz had a ton of investments, and the harvest had just come in. The barley harvest, the wheat harvest, it was brand new. So he couldn't go out beforehand because he was sitting Shiva. He was in the mourning process for his wife. So this was the first opportunity to go check on his investments. But more than that, I'll give you a very easy answer. This was all God's design. In other words, the fact that she would choose the field, he owned a ton of fields. This wasn't his only field that he owned. The fact that he was there at the moment, in the same way that she came to town, mm-hmm. when his wife departed for the next world and he was burying his wife as his new wife is coming to town, unbeknownst to both of them, it's all by design, clearly. Okay? So getting back to Boaz again. So he's not really Boaz, because the rabbis debate his identity. And the Gemara, the Talmud and Baba Basra says his actual real name in the book of Judges, he's only listed like in three verses. His name was Ifsan. But because he lost everything under that name, I think I mentioned to you that he buried 120 offspring. All of them, they died. So the fact that he could pick himself up at age 80 and even think that he could perhaps procreate again and have a new life for himself shows the man's, his inner strength, which is defined by his name Boaz. So they're using, as we pointed out in the very first class, they're using euphemistic names for almost every character in our book. Remember, we pointed out that Mahlon and Kilion probably weren't their real names, disease and dying and death probably weren't the real names. They are given, they're ascribed, because the purpose of our book, as we pointed out, just to go back to that first class, is not as a chronological historical novel. It's purely to validate David HaMelech's genealogy and to teach us this remarkable story of what it took to create a David HaMelech, this love story between Rus, Naomi, Rus, Hashem, Rus, and Boaz, all these parts coming together. So Shmuel's not right. In other words, it's deliberately written out of time and out of context. We're not even sure, and one can't really be sure, when you read the text, when the story took place. In other words, if you read the text and you're reading about Boaz, let's say you're a brilliant rabbi, and you have all of Tanakh at your fingertips, 24 books of the Torah, 23, because you don't have Ruth. Okay. So you have all the Torah about Ruth. And someone says, well, there was a guy named Boaz, and he's married to... Okay, place him in history. And let's say this person knows, like a photographic memory, can tell you every name in the Torah. Find me Boaz. He wouldn't find you Boaz. He's nowhere except here. In other words, if I told you Ifsan, and you were brilliant, you could take me in the book of Judges to Ifsan. You say, oh, there's Ifsan. Three verses. Congratulations. You won Jeopardy. But Boaz doesn't exist except in our text. So in other words, his name was probably not Boaz. We're referring to him by that name as a praise for his intestinal fortitude, for what he brought and what he will bring to the table. Okay? So I think, did we answer our questions tonight? Good. So let's carry on. So let's look carefully at verse Yud Beis, number 12, because there's a gorgeous little rem as a hint that is alluded to here. So you asked, Doctor, by the way, you asked me, was it his right to give the blessing, the bracha? So clearly, in the same way that he invoked the name of God last week when he comes to greet his workers in the field for the first time. He wants to bring a rapprochement because people are estranged from each other, and he wants to repair the damage done by this xenophobic type of attitude that was prevalent in Bethlehem at the time. He goes to the people, and what does he say to them? Remember, he says, Hashem imachem, God should be with you. That's a blessing. So when I say to you, if I see you and I see, shake your hand and say, Shalom Aleichem, Shalom is a euphemism for God. So I'm saying God should be with you. Right? Sort of like Star Wars, you know, may the force be with you. It's the same idea. We're using a euphemism. Shalom is like the force. Right? It's a kinoi. It's a nickname for God. So it's the same idea. So anyone can use the name of God. You're saying, well, why would it have any substance, right? Because if the wrong person gives you a blessing, it matters not. But if you get a blessing from the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage of that generation, you know, you would think it's a nice thing.
Right?
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, let's look carefully, because this is a very cute little play on words. He says to her in Pasuk Yud Beis, in number 12, Yishalem Hashem Pa'aleich, may God, he should pay you back for your handiwork, everything you've done, for what you have accomplished, Ruth. Utehi maskurteich shleima, may your sechar be shalem, full. So if you look at the word shleima, take out the nikudot, take out the vowels. Remember, nothing in the Torah is written with vowels. Okay, we put the vowels there for our basis for our reading. So, but take out the word shlema, shalem, complete, whole. So you could read it as shlema. You can also read it as a very famous person. You know what he really said to her?
Shlomo.
Shlomo. You got it. You got it. Very well. Very well said. Did you see that? Jeff picked up on it? Utehi maskurteich, your reward, Boaz says to Ruth, should be shlema, shlomo. King Solomon is going to be your reward, my dear. Wow. Now, did he understand this? Probably not. I don't think when Boaz gave the blessing, but when Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel's writing this down, whether he's directly quoting or paraphrasing the intent, Samuel's telling us that when he said those words, he blesses her as a direct result of his blessing, he has King David, and of course King David's equally famous son, Solomon, Shlomo, who built the temple. So he's saying, may your reward for all that you've done be Solomon. Wow. So it's right there. So if you like a nice little sort of a Hasidic Shavuot, there it is, very mystical. Okay, verse number 13, Yud Gimel. Now, Vatomer, so she responds, Ruth, Emsachem beinecha adoni kini chamtani. All right, if so, then I should continue to find favor in your eyes because you have comforted me. You've given me nechama. Nechama, of course, is what we wish to a mourner. V'chidibarta alev shifchasecha. And because you have spoken to the heart of your maidservant, your handmaiden. V'anachi lohayeh ka'achas shifchasecha. Because I am not even as worthy as one of your maidservants. Okay, let's take this verse apart very quickly. Well, she says, I accept. Again, how do you understand this unless we understand it the way we explained it last week? She was reluctant to say yes. Why? Because her string's attached. He, in just a very short verse or two, says to her, my dear, there's no strings attached. Whatever you think I'm giving you with a little bit of barley is absolutely nothing in comparison to what you've already given to me through your heroic acts on behalf of Naomi, on behalf of yourself coming back to this alien nation. You've already given me the world. Now what has she really given him? Well, what a convert gives to us. When you have a righteous convert who comes and chooses 613 laws. Remember we said the word Ruth is 606 in Gematria and Jewish numerology, and there were already seven Noahide laws that every man, woman, and child, Jewish or non, has to keep. So she took the 606 on herself. So there's Torah commandments, so she took all 613. It's inspirational when you meet someone who chose Judaism because it's not granted, it was earned. It's sort of like comparing someone, and this is not to diminish anyone you've ever met in your life, who, you know, let's say received a huge, was an heiress or an heir to a huge fortune, because very often people who receive fortunes, you know, take that fortune and make it into bigger fortunes and carry on and make the company bigger and greater and do wonderful things. It's not a diminishment. But we all know that when you compare someone, let's say, who did it all on their own, entrepreneurially versus someone who, let's say, is like, you know, Prince Charles, I'll just use an example, you know, who's given this multi-million, billion-dollar legacy, not necessarily because he's the best and the brightest or the most handsome, but because he's the heir to the throne and he gets the Buckingham Palace fortune, right? He gets the House of Windsor. It's all his by his birth, by it back to birth. So he's not necessarily England's best and brightest. Well, we're not speaking disparagingly about Charles, okay? We're just speaking in generality as an example. But somebody who earned it themselves, who and in other words, in a weird way, we're saying that Ahasuerus is more laudable than someone who had it given to them because mommy and daddy were the king and queen. Because Ahasuerus in the book of Esther, right, did it on his own. We don't like him. He's a little bit of a nefarious character. But you got to give him credit. His rise to the top was his own, of his own making, right? So the same thing here. Somebody who chooses Judaism, they're making themselves something. For us, every, you know, when it's foisted on us as a fact of birth, it doesn't mean we're less, God forbid, but we're definitely not more. So you know how people tragically belittle people who are converts to Judaism? I mean, what a joke. They're such idiots. Not only, you shouldn't belittle someone who chooses Judaism, they're greater than you are. So shut up, you know, praise them. I mean, halavada, you should walk in their shoes, right? That should be the attitude. Can you imagine? And there are people who walk around and they say, oh, well, no. They look at their genealogy. Really? And your genealogy is so great? Go back to the Passover Haggadah a little bit better, my friend. You think Abraham and Sarah's grandparents, what were they doing? They were running around worshiping idols. So be a little humble here, okay? They're greater than you. So it's, in other words, it's literally counterintuitive. Because we know tragically there are our own people who diminish people who are outsiders. And it's the opposite. They're greater than we are. And that's what Boaz is saying. So then this is the nature of the kindness. The kindness was given by Boaz as a response to the greater kindness already received from the example and the role model of Ruth. And so once Ruth understands that it is a mutual relationship, she says, absolutely, I should continue. So we hear that. Because it's the only explanation. Do you hear that? There was nothing else happened in those two verses between her reluctance to her acceptance, except for his praise of her accomplishments. So clearly that is the issue. There could be no other issue. Weiter, let's go on. Pasuk Yud Dalad, number 14. Vayomer La Boaz eita ochel. So then Boaz speaks to her. It was dinner time. Time to eat. He says, "Goshi halom v'achalt min alechem." Come here at the head table, my dear, and you should eat from the food that we have. We have a little bit of a nice meal here. The tavalt piteich b'chometz. You should dip your bread, your food, in vinegar. Rabbis say, why vinegar? Apparently vinegar has a positive effect if somebody's a little bit, has been exposed to sun, and he was concerned, the rabbis say, that because she was a princess, she's not used to working out in the heat of the day, and apparently vinegar can relieve some of the heat prostration effects, so he offers her some vinegar, which was common back then. Vateshed mitzada kotzrin. But rather than accept his offer to sit at the head table, she sits at the side of the harvesters, not to draw attention to herself. She refuses nicely, demurely, but she refuses him in his acceptance of the seat, the VIP seat. Vayitzbat lo kali, and he handed her some parched grain. Vatochal vatispa, she ate, she was soveya, vechalta v'savata, right? Like we say in the Torah, she ate and she was satisfied. Va Tosar. She even had leftover. He was a little bit generous, gave her a nice portion. Now, this is a mind-bending verse. You ready for this? This is great. I love this. He gave her parched grain, kali. Now, he's Boaz, okay? You know, he could have taken her to Abigail's and gotten her a nice steak in New York, nice kosher steak, right? You know? He gives her parched grain. The rabbi said, you know, poor Boaz, if only he knew that every school child for history and every person sitting around in Ohel Tzedek would learn what he gave her explicitly that would be listed in the verse by Samuel, he would have given her fattened cows. But he gave her parched grain. He didn't understand it would all be recorded. So why I say this is mind-bending? Because it's gorgeous. Because think about it. If we had a biographer following us everywhere, scrutinizing your actions and recording your actions, your whole life would be different. Everything you say, everything you do, your whole modus operandi would be changed because you would be under constant scrutiny and everything would be recorded. But that is the reality. See? It is a reality. We say this, you know, there's a Sefer HaZichronot, God has his book of remembrances, good, the bad, the ugly, it's all there. So if we could somehow come in touch with the fact that we're not alone. When we think we're alone, of course we're not alone. Then everything's been recorded. It's all there. All of it. That it would sort of give us a sense of that it's there's no fleeting moments. No. Each moment could be the moment. Had he known, had you said, excuse me, well, let's stop for a second. Before you decide what to give to the lovely, gracious Ruth, I'm writing this down. I'm going to record it. We're going to read it for 3,000 years. Right? Boaz would have stopped and said, excuse me, Mario Batali, come here. Go to the kitchen. He's a famous chef. Food Network. Go to the kitchen and, you know, whip up something really fancy schmancy. This lady's going to dine with the stars tonight. Right? No. So that's the point. Nobody stopped him, and nobody said Samuel's going to record it. Had he known, the rabbi said, he would have given her fattened cows. Well, what about our own lives? We never know at any opportunity what that moment, what that opportunity is going to be, and how that might be the only reason you're here. We all think in our diminished capacity, because of our humanity, we don't really know the beginning and the end of anything. But all we know is that on that journey, we can sometimes see, oh, this is big, right? We don't really know if it's big or not. But at the end of that journey, it could be, God might say, you know, you were paying so close attention to this and this and this, and I'm glad that you did that. That was great. Congratulations. But, you know, that little diversion you took along that journey, that's the only reason I brought you here. That was the crucial part. But what would our response be? Oh, had I known, I would have given the fattened cows. But that's the whole point. You can't know. So therefore, each mitzvah, each opportunity, each time we have to do a chesed with somebody, if we would only imagine just for a moment that it's, you know, going down, and with today's, you know, proliferation of smartphones, kind of everything kind of is recorded, right? For better or worse, you know, between the cameras they have all over the cities now and the satellites and Google, everything, we are kind of being recorded somewhere, right? I mean, if they want us, they'll get us, right? Everything, good, bad, and the ugly, is now on record. God has even a better cell system, believe it or not, you know? And it's just a very sobering but empowering thought, right? Never to diminish those moments. Let's carry on. So he gives her the parched grain, and she eats and she has leftover. Vatokam lelake, and then she gets up to glean. Wait a minute, whoa. Rus, didn't you hear that Boaz said you can be the guest of honor at the table? You shouldn't go to any other field. Stay here, I'll support you. Gleaning means that she's only picking the two little remnants that have fallen by accident by the side of the, you know, by the harvest. Why? Because she did hear. But she was very careful not to take what wasn't hers. So she said, well, the gleaning I know is mine. I'm not going to accept something beyond that. It's not right. So she got up to glean. Vayitzav Boaz es na'arav lemor. So Boaz commands his young men in the field, and he says to them, you know, do you see this lady over here? Let me tell you a few things about her. First of all, gam bein ha'amarin telake v'lo tachlimuha. First of all, let her glean even among the sheaves, which she's not really entitled to as a poor person, but don't embarrass her. Don't say, psst, young lady, Torah law prohibits gleaning from that part, only on the side. Shut up. Leave her alone. Secondly, the gam, and also he says to his young man, shol tasholu la min hatzvatim. You know, just like wink, wink, pull out some real parts of the barley harvest and throw them down and pretend that you forgot them. And then just conveniently leave these extras for her to glean. Don't rebuke her. In other words, not only should you allow her to take more than what Torah permits, but accidentally pull out and throw some extras her way. Okay? And so what did she do? She gleans in the field until evening. So even though she was given license to do whatever she wanted to do, she didn't take advantage of it yet. She gleaned, and that's why it took her so long, until evening. In other words, the little meal's over, she gets up, she goes back to her work, gleaning two but not three, from the side but not in between. In other words, he gave her permission, she did not take license yet. Shows something about her personality. Okay? And it says, "Vatachbot et asher liketo." So she beat out in the field because there are enormous stalks of barley. So she was allowed to beat them out. Normally, you're not allowed to beat them out there. The poor people that would leave the husks and all that stuff there, you're normally not allowed to. But in deference of who Ruth is, she was allowed, nobody would touch her after he blew away the foreman in her defense, and after he ordered his men not to touch her. So she's allowed to like sort of beat out the long stalks of the barley so that she can get access to the actual flour. She's allowed to thresh it right there. Vayhi ke'efas arim. And she has an enormous amount, an epha of barley. We just finished number 17, Yud Zayin, which is enormous amount. The rabbis actually go through how much it is. It's like a ton of this barley. Vatisa, so she lifts it up. It took a lot of effort. Vatavo ha'ir, she comes back to the city. Now, all day long, Naomi's been waiting at home. Remember, she's an alien in an alien country. She's putting little pieces like in a you know, in a fairy tale down to find her way home. So Naomi is like, oh my gosh, where's Ruth? Did she get lost? Did she get hurt? Did someone molest her or, you know, hurt her? What happened? She has no way to know. She's been waiting all day, anticipating, please God, let Ruth come home. So what happens? She's coming home now. Listen, it's beautiful. So what happens? So she comes into the city. Vatera chamota et asher liketa. And when her mother-in-law, Naomi, sees the enormous amount of barley that she has been able to gather, vatomer la chamota. So her mother-in-law says to her, Efu liketa yom va'ana asit? Where did you glean today? And what exactly did you do for this? Like, where did you work? Yehi makirech baruch. Whoever took notice of you, whoever recognized your greatness and allowed you to stay in their field, Baruch, may God bless them. Vategel chamata, and then she went and told her mother-in-law, Eita sher asata imo, everything that she did for him, Vatomer, and she said, Shem ha'ish asher asiti imo hayom, the man who I made his world today, that I did all these wonderful things for him today, Boaz is his name. How do you like that? Now, she doesn't really know the relationship between Boaz and her own mother-in-law, Naomi. Ruth is totally ignorant of this. She doesn't understand that this is like a mind-bending thing, that Boaz is a potential redeemer for everything in their world. She has no clue. She's clueless. So, listen to this. Naomi says in the verse, tell me, you know, let's give recognition and blessing to the man who owned the field and allowed you to stay and had this great surplus amount of food. What did you do to earn this? She says, what did I do? Oh, you want to know? The man who I made his world today. Oh, his name's Boaz. So this is the contrast, you see? She's saying, well, how come he was so generous? And she says, generous? By my choices that I have made, this man has been elevated in his own spirituality, and he is in awe of everything that I have done in my journey. Therefore, I did for him, she says. You see it? She's actually accenting that. Look at the words. Look at the words at the end of your test, 19. It says, Shema ish asher asiti imo, the name of the man whom I worked. But that doesn't really mean work. It's a loose translation. Avodah is work. Asita means like what I did for him. What I did for him is what we said earlier. By my choices as a ger, as a true convert to Judaism, I made his world already. So thank you very, very much. So in other words, that's the reciprocity of the arrangement that she is now imparting, Ruth is, to Naomi. Okay? Now, interesting. Do you notice it said the word hakireni twice already? To recognize me. I had it earlier, just a few verses ago, that where she says to Boaz, why'd you recognize me? And then here, she says that, how come you have all this food? Yehi makirech baruch. The one who recognized you should be blessed. Now, on a simple level, you wouldn't mean recognized you. What does that mean? Here it says, like in the translation of the Rabbi Art Scroll HaKodesh, such generous notice of you. Well, it doesn't say that. Who took notice of you? It doesn't say generous notice. He's adding. The one who saw you. What does that mean? So on a simple level, you say, well, meaning somebody who obviously saw that you were a Moabitess, but then didn't just get turned off by your limitations and your shortcomings, but rather took in you. But the word makir has other connotations. Does anyone remember the word in Genesis, the word to recognize? It comes up in a very profound way. Okay? I'll remind you. Judah takes Joseph's coat, the torn coat of many colors, after they sell him. And he brings it back to Yaakov, their dad. And he shows, we know it's Judah from the Midrash. And Judah presents the torn coat, the technicolor dream coat, Donny Osmond's, right? They ripped it off and shredded it, and they bring it, and they present it to Jacob, and says, Hakerna, please recognize Dad. Is this your Ksonis Binchahi? Is this the precious little ketonet, the tunic, the technicolor dream coat of your son? And it says he recognized it, and he yells out, oh, a wild animal devoured him. The wild animal is Judah the lion. He was accusing him. You killed him. Of course. You're jealous. You've always been jealous of Joseph. But what's stunning is the next chapter. No one reads the chapter because it's not age appropriate for children. But chapter 38 is the famous story of Judah and Tamar. Right? Judah has three children. The first dies. The second one dies also because he doesn't want to impregnate his former sister-in-law because he realizes the child in Levirate marriage, as we spoke about, belongs to the dead brother. So he didn't want to do that, so he died also. And the younger one is sent home. Judah himself goes out after many, many years. And Tamar, his former daughter-in-law, right, who was supposed to be waiting for the young son to get married, it's not happening. She dresses up very fancy-schmancy, goes out in a crossy. He perceives her to be a prostitute, has a relationship with. She gets pregnant. She's about to be killed. He's in charge of the court. Remember what happened? So it's beautiful, right? Because she doesn't want to embarrass him publicly. But she sends him his staff and his signet ring and his cloak. And she says, you know, you accuse me of like infidelity, of adultery, because it is adultery, even though her own husband's dead. As long as she's in a status of levirate marriage, she's married to the dead brother and therefore ostensibly to the younger brother who has yet to either cut and chase or not. In other words, in the time of the Bible, if the older brother died, and the wife is waiting, that second brother has to make a choice. Yivam, marriage, chalitza, cut and chase. Until that choice is made in front of a court, that woman is still an eshadit, she's still a married woman. You cannot touch her, except for the younger brother. Now, once the choice is made to cut and chase, then the woman's a free woman, because her husband's dead, right? That's one of the two ways a woman gets out of a relationship, divorce or death. So what happened? She sends these secretly to Judah. Judah's about to have her literally burned at the stake because of adultery, and says, you know, the man who was with me and got me pregnant and the children that I carry in my womb, these things belong to him. By the way, Hakerna, please Haker, could you please recognize who do they belong to? Judah, who do they belong to? Right, and Judah's like, oh my gosh. And then he says, of course, he could have let her die and not embarrass himself because it was him. What does he do? He says, she's more righteous than me, right? Sadka mimeni. He stands up in front of his father. Jacob's there. His grandfather Isaac's there. Judah humiliates himself and says, you know what? She's righteous and I'm wrong. It was me. I'm the father. And then he marries her and they have beautiful sons. Now, why is this so beautiful? Who do you think the son was that they had? Peretz and Zerah are the twins. You know who Peretz is the great-grandfather of? Boaz. Boaz, our Boaz, comes directly from the relationship of Judah and Tamar on the dad's side, and the word haker is used there deliberately so in the Torah, okay, and echoed here by Samuel in our book to bring us full circle that Judah and Tamar create Boaz's great Zadie, the grandfather, and then there's, why did you recognize me? Who's the man who recognized you? So it's going totally back to bring us full circle in the relationship. And of course, what the ultimate irony is going to be is when Boaz will marry Ruth, it's a form of what? Yivam, right? It's levirate marriage, which is exactly what Judah did with Tamar. So in other words, it's the completion of that circle in the exact same way. There's a difference here. What's the difference? Because Tamar was loved by Judah only after the fact. He fell in love with her. He loved her. She's great. But when he was with her the first time, he didn't know she was Tamar, correct? He didn't know that was his own daughter-in-law. He never would have been with her. He thought she was a Kadesha, a prostitute. So the love was from Tamar towards Judah, but it wasn't reciprocal. Ah, that changes, because Boaz and Ruth have this mutuality in their relationship now. So the love will be expressed in both ways. So please God, next week and the week after, we will continue our journey on the magical book of Ruth. Thank you, everyone.